I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. We've just witnessed the American election, and we've seen politics get a little coarser and a little more negative than previously. What accounts for the lack of civility in the political discourse? Well, my guest now, Mark Kingwell, looks beyond politics as well to popular culture, the media, technology, literature, architecture, among many other things, in his new book, a collection of very thoughtful, sometimes challenging, often thought-provoking pieces, Unruly Voices, Essays in Democracy, Civility, and the Human Imagination. 17 essays are in this book, and they bring together a lot. In the time we have with Professor Kingwell, I'll ask him to share some of his observations, some of his ideas, and some of the prescriptions he might have for a democracy that lacks empathy and civility. Actually, a necessary question is whether civility is the same thing as manners. Mark Kingwell is a noted public intellectual, a contributing editor to Harper's Magazine, and a professor of philosophy at the University of Toronto. He has written 17 books, including bestsellers and prize winners such as A Civil Tongue, The World We Want, Better Living, Glenn Gould, and Concrete Reveries. He joins me from Toronto this day. This book is published by Biblioasis. I'm very pleased to welcome to the Plant on the Line program Mark Kingwell. Professor Kingwell, good morning.
Hi, I'm very happy to be here with you. Thanks.
Thanks for joining us. So, 1995 was when A Civil Tongue was published. I was 13 at the time, so I didn't read it, and I still haven't. But what do you say about civility in the course of that book to today with Unruly Voices?
Well, that was my first book, I should say, so yeah. I wasn't that old myself at the time.
Right.
I'm not as young as you.
Yeah.
The argument I wanted to make there was a very straightforward argument in political theory about the value of civility as a virtue, and specifically as a political virtue. So as you rightly say, one of the questions that needs to be cleared up immediately is the difference between civility and manners, or politeness, or etiquette, or all of these associated behaviors that have to do with social comportment. Those things are important, and you know, parents should teach their children good manners and so on. But civility is a much more searching and demanding idea that's rooted in traditions of civic republicanism and commitment to a res publica, you know, a public thing, a shared society. You can even trace, as I did in that book, the roots all the way back to Aristotelian conceptions of what it means to be a good person and a good citizen. So the argument was, I thought, timely. As I've said, you know, it didn't seem to take hold with politicians to the degree that I had hoped. These years since 95 have witnessed, I think it's fair to say, a strong decline in the levels of political civility, especially among pundits and politicians. I'm not so sure it's true among average citizens, and this is something I want to suggest in the new book, is that in a way the thing to do is to take democracy out of the hands of politics and put it back into a kind of lived everyday reality. In this book, there are lots of essays, and only a couple of them actually directly address civility. But the ones that do, especially the core essay, sort of right in the middle of the book,
mm-hmm.
offers a different kind of argument. Instead of arguing, you know, yay, civility, you know, civility is a good thing, it shows why incivility is actually self-defeating. And this is a version of a collective action problem argument, as we would call it, where you can demonstrate that the arms race of attack ads, for example, actually hollows out public discourse such that even the short-term winners are long-term losers. And this is an important argument because it lines up with other similar negative arguments about collective action problems. You can show why people, while pursuing their specific individual interest, actually are not even going to serve themselves, let alone be able to cooperate with others. So I think that shift in focus in terms of the argument links this present book to my very first one, but with a new kind of twist or new polarity.
In 1995, did you foresee the gradual decline in political discourse?
It was already obvious through the 1980s and early 90s with the growing importance of the 24-hour news cycle and the resort to ad hominem attacks in political advertising, that this was happening. I don't think anyone at the time could have predicted what we have now seen, which is that each year's worst thing becomes the baseline for the next cycle.
Yeah.
So that this is really a kind of ratchet effect, because you have to constantly have to escalate the attack in order to be heard as a signal in the background noise of political buzz. I really don't think anybody thought it would be so bad. And by the way, I should say, I often am accused of what I think of as the Fogies fallacy, which is to imagine that there was some golden age of blissfully polite exchange of, polished phrases. No, and democracies are rough and tumble things. You need loud voices and committed voices. What you don't need are attacks that actually hurt discourse itself. And this is part of what I play with in the phrase unruly voices. There are the unruly voices that we want in a democratic society, that sense of a roiling and active citizenry. But then there is the voice that actually makes the game worse for everyone. And making that argument and using that distinction is a huge part of what it means to be a citizen, actually.
Now, most of the people listening to us online probably haven't read this book, and we'd like them to pick up the book, I guess. Are there specific people that are responsible for all this? I mean, can you point to certain people, politicians, maybe thinkers, perhaps, who have been responsible for this decline?
Yeah, I would probably have my own personal rogues gallery of that. I think of people like Ann Coulter and Newt Gingrich south of the border, and Ezra Levant in Canada, and people who are whose being in the world is all about making a kind of noise, and who, while they apparently seem engaged in language that is rational, in fact are undermining the very possibility of rational discourse. I don't blame these people specifically because I think they're evil. I don't think they're evil. Well, Ann Coulter might be evil. But the pursuit of one's particular interest can be so overwhelming in driving one's actions that almost the effects are impossible to see. And so this is not something that's should be pinned only to a few. This is a systematic problem, and it has structural effects. So while I would have my hit list, I think it's important to see that in a sense everybody is responsible for this. And there is a reason why politicians' advisors say that they should go negative in ads. The reason they always give is that it works. Now, it's working is not a sufficient justification. That's one thing. But the second thing we have to see, that it's working, is something that we do as citizens.
Yeah.
So it's really important to see this as not sort of finger-pointing or blaming, but rather an acknowledgement of a systematic problem, a comprehensive problem.
So what do we do then as a citizen? I mean, is it enough that we vote? I mean, do we have to write letters to the editor? Do we have to show up at rallies? I mean, what can we do?
I think all of the traditional mechanisms of citizen engagement are important to revitalize. And so that's, yes, the first thing is to make sure that we actually are citizens and not just consumers of products and services that we purchase in exchange for taxation. And unfortunately, I think for many people in many Western democracies and elsewhere, this is how they view their sense of relation to government. And governments often encourage this. I think the conservative government of Stephen Harper in Canada has very much taken advantage of a kind of consumer model of swapping taxes for services.
Transactions, right?
Yeah, transactions. And this is not what citizenship should be. So that's the first thing. But the second thing is, as I said before, I think, we live in a time of actually quite interesting upheaval in terms of the everyday experience of social life. And I find myself more and more inclined to, not violent, but anarchistic peelings away, or I sometimes call it fugitive democracy, a democracy that is less and less interested in the struggles of this declining discourse, and more interested in forming bonds at the ground level between myself and others, who, after all, are the entities who give me my identity in the first place. Now, you can't have one without the other. I think that's one of the problems that we, those of us who are suspended somewhere between democratic socialism and democratic anarchism, you need structures. You need public trust and taxation. But it's not just about the election cycle. It's not just about official politics or media-sanctioned discussion. Real democratic discourse, real democratic life, might well lie elsewhere. I think increasingly it does.
Now, what role does technology have in all that?
Very good question, because we saw, I'm mostly uninterested or unimpressed with people's preoccupation with social media, but we saw with the Arab Spring how Facebook and Twitter, to just take the two most prominent examples, yeah, allow us to communicate with each other and form lines of association, which are really off the grid of official communications culture. This is fantastic. I mean, this is something that democratic movements and activists have been dreaming of for years. Now, at the same time, of course, those same social media can be put largely to banal purposes. But when has this not been true? You know, the printing press was an absolutely revolutionary and democratic invention, even if the vast bulk of the books that have ever been printed in human history are trash. So one thing doesn't have to mean the other thing isn't true. But I'm very excited about these kinds of possibilities. I don't see much of it yet in North America, although in the 2008 Obama presidential campaign in the U.S., there was some very effective use of non-traditional communications methods, and getting out the vote among younger people, for example, was an obvious benefit of that.
In another part of the book, in another essay, I guess, you do talk about the sort of the downfalls of social media. I mean, I know you don't tweet or Facebook yourself, but that builds into something that you argue in the book for a greater imagination, more creativity, say. And you think that at the same time, while we have, you know, things like the Arab Spring, people that are on social media a lot may not be as empathetic as others that aren't, perhaps. I mean, is that the argument that you're making in the book?
That is the argument, and it's not just something I think. It's something that at least has some experimental sanction. Studies have shown, there are only a few of them so far, but they have indicated that people who spend a lot of time in, let's call it, narcissistic use of social media, to distinguish it from what I was just talking about, mm-hmm, actually demonstrate empathy deficits. That's to say, now this would, by the way, would be true of people who spent time in narcissistic anything. So it's important never to blame the media as such. But it's the way that media facilitates a certain kind of self-involvement, which apparently has led to, among heavy users, and especially younger heavy users, less of a regard for the feelings and interests of others. Well, that's kind of alarming. Yeah. And if it continues, will be even more alarming. It's fascinating to me to watch this moment, you know, as a kind of McLuhan inflected intellectual, where people seem to have much more connection all of a sudden, you know, circles of friends, and they seem to be in touch with people all the time. And yet, in fact, on a deeper level, it's really a kind of purely self-involved activity. And I know there will be lots of people who want to push back on that, and that's great. That's the discussion we should be having. But that is the evidence in some cases.
So what's the prescription then?
Well,
I mean, how do we strike a balance between the good of social media and then sort of the negative side of it?
Yeah, I mean, in the book, I argue that the cultivation of empathy and sympathy, which is the more 18th century word for what we're talking about, that is, you know, regard for the other. In the 21st century, empathy is the word we've chosen, even though they're conceptually distinct, but it doesn't matter. But I argue that what has always been true is that imagination is necessary for this. And it's a deeper truth than just about our moment or about social media. If we don't imagine the lived life of the other and see that other is necessary for our own existence and identity, if we're not able to make that imaginative leap, then there is nothing to hold together a democratic society. Procedures and institutions and governments will not do it. And we've seen this. We've seen that when things reduce to transaction, as you mentioned before, people start to atomize, and they might have strong family connections that are vestigial, but their sense of belonging to a larger whole is eroded. And the only way that we can come back together is to see the fellow citizen, the other, as somebody worth caring about. That's prior, actually, to how you treat somebody, how you view a democratic process, how you live your life in the daily ways of, say, how you drive or interact at work or whatever. So it's baseline. And the traditional ways of cultivating imagination, of course, have been in the liberal arts, in the humanities, and aesthetic experience. So the stealth argument, especially towards the end of this collection of essays, is a fairly traditional defense of the liberal imagination.
So that's reading more poetry, fiction, literature, I suppose, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
And what's the quote from Fry that arguments don't really work, but it's sort of literature that convinces people, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, this is in a sense, I quote that, but I don't think he's quite right, because you need both. You need the argument as the execution, but the argument will only carry the day if you already care about the other person, and that's the thing that is not actually rational in a sort of strict sense. It's kind of emotional, but this is a kind of connection, a kind of knowledge, we could even say, that comes from that emotional connection to another person. And yeah, I mean, it probably sounds a little silly to say read more poetry, although I think people should read more poetry. But the experience of art is only the beginning here, right? Because it's not just have more aesthetic experiences yourself. It's how does art, literature, poetry, philosophy teach you about the human experience, about your own being in the world and that of others? That's the deeper thing. And that really isn't a matter of argument. You can use arguments to advance specific points, but it's got to be based on imagination.
What's your day like? And in the course of reading this book, I was wondering that. Like, I mean, do you still not have a cell phone?
Yeah, I don't have a cell phone. No. Yeah.
So I'm wondering, what did you, I mean? You read the papers, obviously. You do a lot of reading for your work.
Yeah.
Did you watch television? Do you read, say, fiction? I mean, how does that work for you in your daily activities?
Yeah, I have to say, on some days, I spend more and more time looking for payphones, which are disappearing even from large cities. I had to do a conference call last week, and I wasn't here at my university office where I have a landline.
Uh-huh.
I was at home where I also have a landline in my home office, but it was broken. So I told the person I would just go down to the corner diner and use the payphone there, because there had been a payphone there for years, but it's gone. It's been torn out. And the pub across the street, likewise, no payphone. So I went. I had to go for blocks and blocks before I could find one. New York, downtown Manhattan, is probably the only place where you can reliably find them now. I was in D.C. last year, and I think I found the last working payphone in all of District of Columbia.
Yeah.
So I suppose one of these days I'm going to have to break down and get one. I do spend a lot of time reading. When I'm teaching, I spend a lot of time reading specifically for what I'm teaching and what I'm researching. But I also read a lot of fiction. I probably read at least two novels a week or one and a half novels a week. And I try to read poetry, mostly by friends of mine. And I do spend a lot of time online. I shouldn't give the sense that I don't. I read most newspapers and magazines in their online versions. I spend a lot of time on email. And I have a couple of online communities that I'm part of, and that is an active participation on a daily basis.
Do you watch television much, like shows
and
things?
Yeah, I do. I this is sort of interesting. I've never been asked this kind of question before, but I love to watch sports on television. I'm a huge sports fan, and I really like long form television. So, like The Wire, for example, which I think is a masterpiece. But I'll watch old movies, and I like the Food Channel. I like cooking shows and Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. That's one of my favorites.
Yeah. So I guess in television, because I mean, you hear people that they like Breaking Bad or Mad Men or something like that, or Downton Abbey even.
Right.
I mean, that's still very much a part of the cultivating of the imagination, right? I mean, even though people think that television is trash, or most of it can be.
Yeah, no, I think there are good persuasive arguments that those kinds of serial dramas or comedy dramas are substantial works of art in their own right. I think, there's nothing inherent in television as a medium that means it can't produce great art, and it certainly has. It's interesting to me to watch how people latch on or don't latch on. So I haven't gotten into Breaking Bad, for example, but a couple of my close friends are just nuts about it. So that's sort of one of those things you think, well, maybe one of these days, like, I haven't read that huge novel yet, but maybe one of these days I'll be in the right mood. And that's great. It's a whole different way of appreciating that medium. When I was growing up, we would watch anything. There were three channels, and I would get home from school and turn on the TV and watch it pretty much I would do my homework in front of a TV, and my parents never seemed to mind that much, and it doesn't seem to have affected me that badly. I've always been skeptical of those arguments that TV somehow makes you dumb.
Yeah. You were in Vancouver last week, I understand, for a speaking engagement. Is that correct?
Actually, it was postponed. It's going to be happening in February now.
I see. You've been out here before, and you've spent some time here. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah. And much of my family is out there these days.
Yeah. So I read somewhere that you described Toronto as smug, New York as self-important. How do we rate?
You make me feel like I have to come up with a similarly pejorative way.
Or a positive one, you know,
yeah.
Right?
I want to say that there's something about Vancouver that I very much like and something that I don't like. What I very much like there is the relaxed kind of attitude about urban living. What I don't like is sort of an extreme version of that, which is, I wouldn't call it smugness, but it's more like it's chilled to the point of a fault. You know, it's just, I sometimes feel like there's an indifference or a lack of energy there, because people are often off, you know, in their particular recreational projects, and you don't get a lot of sense of urban connection, maybe put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is based on visits and never having lived there, so I hope nobody's going to want to string me up.
They'll meet you at the airport when you come in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I believe me, though, I look forward to every visit to Vancouver. It's one of my favorite cities to visit. It's beautiful, obviously. The sushi's amazing, and I love walking around in Vancouver.
Yeah, and how does our architecture rank? I mean, that's something that you talk about in your work. I mean, when I see on television and sort lately, you're asked about architecture and how that shapes a city.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on how that our architecture shapes Vancouver?
Yeah, I mean, it's not as bad as it easily could have been. Let me put it that way, sort of negatively, you know. I guess it was Doug Copeland who first called it City of Glass.
Right.
And, of course, it gives you that very... It's all that sort of sponge sugar glass cladding in the towers, which I kind of like. And I think it's appropriate to the climate. The best thing that Vancouver's done architecturally in the last little while is the convention center and the reclamation of the waterfront on the inlet, which is just tremendous. And, you know, that you could... I'll tell you, last time I was in Vancouver, earlier this year, for the DOXA, Documentary Film Festival,
mm-hmm.
I took the water taxi across to Granville Island for breakfast,
mm-hmm.
and I came back, and I walked all the way around through part of Stanley Park, and then along the Cole Harbour shore, right into downtown. And that is just an amazing thing, that you can do that in a major, major urban center, to have that kind of walk where you have everything. You have little neighborhoods, you have skyscrapers, you have a park, which is massive and you know, dense with wildlife. I love that. I just think that's, you know, amazing. Toronto could learn a lot about how to deal with its physical site. You know, we've brutalized our waterfront here. I would like to see maybe more buildings of distinction. There's not much on the skyline that really catches the eye. And every great city should have at least a few signature buildings that so that you can see it and say, oh, yeah, that's that city.
Yeah. As an author, as a philosopher, as a public thinker, is it enough for you that people read your book or buy your book? I mean, do they have to subscribe to whatever your way of thinking is?
Oh, certainly not. Certainly not. Now, of course, when I write in an argumentative way, I'm trying to convince somebody of something.
Mm-hmm.
But even in this collection of essays, you'll see that often I don't write in straightforward argument. I have here some interior monologues. I have a dialogue between two voices of different opinions. I have some things that are more ironic than others, and so on. I think that the range is great. There's the voice of authority, the third-person voice of authority that's so typical of most academic writing and most nonfiction writing, just often isn't appropriate. So many times I'm not really even trying to convince somebody of something. I just want to work out some of the contours of a problem or an issue. But there are other times when I'm obviously a highly opinionated person.
Yeah.
I do want to try to convince someone of my position being the correct one. And that's just the beginning. In philosophy, one of the things you learn very early is that no position is safe. no matter how passionately you defend it and no matter how well you think you argued it, there's always going to be somebody coming back with an objection or a counter-argument. And that's the business of discourse.
So this collection really, these are pieces that came out of the last 4 years, right, from 08 to today.
That's right.
Yeah. Looking back at the last 4 years and looking ahead, if you will, are you generally hopeful about where we're headed?
I am, partly because I'm by nature a hopeful person. I should say sometimes I identify with whoever coined the phrase cheery pessimist.
yeah.
Or I think I may have come up with the phrase misanthropic humanist, which is another one I like.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, we're just days from the last U.S. election result, and given my own views, my wife is American, and so I feel a vested interest or close interest in this. I was very, very happy to see President Obama return to office. I think that shows that it shows a lot of things, but one thing that showed us was that the debates or the alleged debates that we were seeing in the media were not really reflective of the demographic and on-the-ground realities of life in America. And what was going on there was reassuring to me, to my personal beliefs and what I think is good for everybody. So that's a really great sign. I would be in a different mood probably if President Romney was coming in January.
Yeah. Growing up, I used to see you a lot on television, in the newspapers and the sort, and then over the last few years you sort of disappeared. Was that conscious or what happened there?
Definitely conscious when it comes to TV, yes. I got very, very, I don't want to say, people accuse you of being overexposed if you do more than one or two TV things in a six-month period, which seems always a little weird, but I got, I think, not fed up, what's the word I want? I just felt it was no longer rewarding or interesting to try to talk about ideas. A lot of things were happening. Television, the CBC included, was getting more and more reductive. So even in a few years since I had started accepting interviews or spots on television, they got shorter and more intellectually narrow. But I also just thought, I don't want to squander my energy on television when I should be focusing on writing books that I hope might last at least a little while.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, that part was a conscious decision. I had a newspaper column for a while in the National Post, and when that ended, I felt I didn't really have a big desire to try to continue that anywhere else. I'm most interested in, when it comes to non-academic publishing, in places like Harper's, where I really feel like the editorial vision is one that aligns with my own interests, and I always feel that they allow writers to bring out their best work. So, I think there was I love radio, by the way. I love the this kind of thing because it's all about the ideas and the voice, and there's an intimacy to it. It's not just that we're talking for longer than a TV spot would allow. It's that nobody's distracted by how you look or whether your hair is weird or, you know, the twitches that your face does. It's just the voice. And I love the intimacy of that, the sense that of a conversation that you and I are having and people are kind of listening in on it. It's really sort of uncanny but awesome. And so I've always said yes to radio. I love radio.
Well, but Professor Kingwell, I've enjoyed this conversation today, and I've enjoyed this book. I appreciate your time, and continued good luck with the book.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure for me, too.
The book is called Unruly Voices, Essays on Democracy, Civility, and the Human Imagination. It's published by Biblioasis. Its author, Mark Kingwell, on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.